Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the explosive news story published today by The Guardian. Kremlin papers appear to show Putin's plot to put Trump in the White House, which is based on documents from a January 22, 2016 meeting in the Kremlin of Putin's National Security Council, at which it was decided to sow, quote, social turmoil in the United States by helping elect Trump, who the Russians considered to be an, quote, impulsive, mentally unstable, and unbalanced individual who suffers from an inferiority complex. Joining us to discuss the documents and where they might have come from is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. We look into the most likely source being Oleg Smolenkov, who was a top aide to the deputy foreign minister in the Kremlin and was exfiltrated out of Russia when Trump was elected because of fears Trump would tell the Russians about this valuable spy the CIA had inside the Kremlin. As for why the leak happened now and not 4 years ago, Scott speculates that the CIA was intimidated by Trump, and only now, with top Pentagon officials going public about what a danger Trump was and still is to our national security, have they been shamed into revealing that this gift to Putin that keeps on giving is a traitor. Then we'll look into the growing possibility that the $579 billion bipartisan infrastructure framework bill, which 11 Republican senators signed on to, will collapse under pressure from Republican dark money groups, or that the Republicans are simply stringing the Democrats along, which is what they did to Obama with the Affordable Care Act. David Karp, a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University and author of The Move-On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy, joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Post, "The Left is Pushing Biden to Spend More. It's a Sound Strategy." Then finally, we'll speak with Anne-Louise Bardach, a Penn USA award-winning journalist described by the Columbia Journalism Review as, quote, the go-to journalist for all things Cuban and Miami. She joins us to discuss how Miami has become the exile capital of the world, with Cuban, Haitian, and Venezuelan exiles cooking up all kinds of plots, while the refugee crisis from these countries worsens and will likely have a detrimental effect on Democrats trying to win the key state of Florida in the next elections. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of this bombshell article in The Guardian from Luke Harding, Julian Borger, and Dan Sabag, titled, "Kremlin Papers Appear to Show Putin's Plot to Put Trump in the White House"? So I've been reporting on this for years now, that Trump is not just a criminal, but he's also a traitor. So from my point of view, it's a bit of a relief to see a major news outlet moving towards revealing the truth about Trump and his relationship with the Russians and the extent to which he's been a useful idiot for Putin. How does it strike you?
Well, I think this is a huge scoop for Luke Harding and the Guardian. I have not seen the underlying documents. I've only read their description of them. But I have to say, it strikes me that everything that's being reported here is just exactly as I had imagined it would have been. And I'd note here that Andrei Sodatov, who I consider to be the most important Russian journalist writing on Russian intelligence matters and the most consistently accurate, is also quoted talking about the documents and giving his assessment that these documents are authentic. And that carries an awful lot of weight with me. So, this would just suggest that what people like Luke Harding have been reporting for several years, what was covered in some of the business intelligence reports that were done by Christopher Steele, is accurate. I mean, not to say that there weren't mistakes there, but the thrust of what they were reporting is definitely accurate.
And of course, the documents come from a key meeting that took place in the Kremlin on the 22nd of January of 2016, as it appeared that Trump was heading to become the nominee for the Republicans. And the Russian and Putin motive was pretty straightforward. They thought Trump was a perfect vehicle to create social turmoil in the United States, and that he was a mentally unstable and unbalanced individual who suffers from an inferiority complex. And my God, has he been the gift that keeps on giving? I mean, Putin could never have even imagined that Trump would launch a coup against the United States itself and have this rabble attack the Capitol and then continue to divide America and even end up in control of one of the two major parties in the United States, the Republican Party. My God, it's breathtaking, the damage that Trump has done.
I think important, you know, that detail, the date of that meeting with his Security Council is significant. The attendees at that meeting are significant because we can check that against reported facts, including photographs that were taken and released by the Kremlin contemporaneously with that meeting. So we know that that meeting, in fact, occurred. We know that those individuals described as having been at that meeting were, in fact, at that meeting. And it's, I mean, this just adds to the strong sense of accuracy about this report. And yes, the assessment of Trump's psychology, you know, it's very, very clear that this is something that intelligence services around the world do. They engage in psychological profile of leading figures and leading political figures. So that they would have profiled Trump is a certainty. Of course they would have. And the conclusions they reached seem to be pretty much the conclusions a lot of American psychologists reached. So, so their support for Trump is premised on the fact that he would be an extremely divisive, damaging and destructive figure in the United States, and therefore exactly the sort of person they would like to see elected as president. And I think after the election in 2020, we see this continuing now. I mean, he is relentless in his desire to destroy the country and to destroy democracy in the country and faith in all of its institutions. And he is having immense success in this. Of course, we see polling out just in the last 24 hours showing that Trump supporters in the American South don't want America. They want to secede from America. They want to reestablish the Confederacy. And Trump supporters around the country generally have a hugely contemptuous attitude towards the United States and U.S. institutions. So that's exactly, I think, what Putin and his intelligence bosses valued in Trump and exactly what they wanted to see happen. So, you know, this probably is the most successful intelligence operation ever undertaken by Russia.
And indeed, the meeting that took place in the Kremlin, the National Security Council meeting on January the 22nd of 2016, the official photograph that you mentioned has, of course, Putin at the head of the table, and then you have the Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, you've got the Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, and then you've got the Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, who's in charge of the GRU, Mikhail Fradkov, the chief of Russia's SVR, foreign intelligence, Alexander Bortnikov, head of the FSB, and Nikolai Patrushev, former head of the FSB, head of the National Security Council, are all there in the photograph. So the one thing that is missing from the article, of course, is the sourcing of where do these documents come from, even though they quote a number of high-ranking intelligence officials, and particularly British intelligence officials, who have said that the documents are absolutely credible and reflect the kind of mindset of Putin and the Russians. So nobody's doubting the provenance, but nobody knows where it comes from. And I'm pretty sure that these highly classified documents from the very top secret inner workings of the Kremlin had to come from Oleg Smolenkov, who was the chief aide to the deputy foreign minister, who had access to Putin's desk, was in and out of it, and he was also working for the CIA. He's the guy that provided the CIA with the information. The Steele dossier obviously got a lot of attention, but it really wasn't anything that the intelligence community acted on. But they did act on what Smolenkov was telling them about Putin basically launching this active measures campaign to hurt Hillary Clinton and elect Trump. And when Trump got elected, Smolenkov was exfiltrated from Russia because the CIA was afraid that Trump would leak his existence to the Russian authorities and that he'd be murdered. He was then placed in witness protection, and then there was a leak from the White House, possibly from Ezra Cohen-Watnick and Kash Patel, of his existence. They gave CNN his address. CNN showed up with a camera crew, and that freaked out the CIA, and they had to move Smolenkov back into hiding in witness protection. But this removed Smolenkov from the possibility of testifying at these important impeachment hearings, and particularly on the Ukraine matter. So that's my guess as to where these documents came from. What do you think?
Well, my thinking is almost identical to yours. So I think, let's just say, first of all, making an assessment of the genuineness of these documents, we would have to examine the documents themselves for certain facial things. And that's the language that's used, the typography, how they were produced, the paper that they're used on, everything else. That would all be highly relevant. So that's one whole line. The second line would be the provenance story. That is, you would trace step by step how these documents came into the hands of The Guardian and Luke Harding, all the way back to the person who initially procured them. I start looking like who would have had access to documents of this sort, who would be a likely person to furnish. And the name that really pops out first is Oleg Smolenkov. And moreover, there have been rumors fluttering around for a long time that he was exfiltrated with a cache of documents, which were highly sensitive things. So I would say we can't say with any certainty, but I would say certainly he would be at the top of the list of people who would be suspected here. He's a person who would have had access to these documents. So if he was the source, that would greatly heighten the view as to their authenticity. And I think that then sets up another question, which is, so why for 4 years did the CIA sit on these documents? To which the simple answer is because of Trump.
Right.
They were operating under his presidency.
Exactly. He's intimidated them. On his first day in office, he went over to the CIA and made that ridiculous speech about what the crowd at his inauguration. And I mean, there's no question that they've been intimidated. And, you know, the CIA, when they leak important stuff, at any rate, they usually do it through foreign media vehicles to have it come back to the United States so that there's no sort of fingerprints on it. But that seems to be the most logical thing, that in effect, the CIA has been shamed into doing the right thing because they were so craven during the Trump administration. And look what's happening now. I mean, they've got to be ashamed when you've got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, you've got General Kelly, General McMaster, all these people leaking profusely to these authors of all these new books that are revealing what an incredible danger Trump has been to the United States. It's just breathtaking that we survived this guy. He was so dangerous, and he was so perfect for the Russians, and so absolutely disastrous for the Americans. So finally, we're getting the truth out. I've always argued that if you get a camera into the Oval Office during the Trump administration, in 5 minutes, the entire American public would realize what a catastrophe they have on their hands, and he'd be out of there. But finally, we're learning about it far too late, of course. So is that possible that, frankly, the CIA finally had to leak this stuff because they're kind of ashamed that, you know, other agencies like the Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon are showing much more courage?
Well, I have to say, Ian, that after reading this, I sat down and composed a note to Luke Harding, and I said, you know, a wonderful story. And the next one I want to know is the Provenance story and what led, after this, having them blockaded for effectively 3 years, what led to a decision now to release it? That's the thing I most would like to know. What were all the circumstances? What were all the facts? I think you put forward the most plausible interpretation. I also think that this is right in the center of this special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. intelligence services. Because, of course, we focus on that special relationship as being about shared intelligence. But that relationship has always historically been about leaks as well. So leaks coming out of the UK system historically have over and over again gone to US intelligence, and US intelligence has leaked them domestically in the US and vice versa. Leaks from the American system have gone to British intelligence or people around it, and they've been leaked to the UK media. So I think the model we see now sort of matches that. And to me, I agree with your analysis. So my suspicion would be that this has come from the American intelligence community, probably at a fairly high echelon.
Right. Well, that's always been the MO of the Five Eyes program, you know, that the Canadians spy on the Americans, the Americans spy on the Canadians, the Australians spy on the British, and vice versa, etc. So that there is that sort of deniability. But I'm not sure, you know, I don't know what the relationship now is with British intelligence and Boris Johnson. Because as far as I know, British intelligence, certainly American intelligence, they can't trust this guy. He's as bad as Trump is. There's evidence, apparently, that the Russians financed Boris Johnson. So he's a real loose cannon, that guy. So I have no idea what kind of... I can't imagine that MI6 and GCHQ trust him one bit.
Well, I think that would lead me to another observation here. That is the subject of this Intelligence Council or Security Council meeting in Russia was active measures involving the U.S. and U.S. elections. But from all the various different sources we've had over the last several years, this is a routine topic before this panel and before the Russian intelligence services. But it's not just the United States. So we've heard that they pay equally close attention to the elections in the UK, and that they have had special operations authorized for Germany, for France, for the Scandinavian countries, for Italy, and on and on and on. So I would say one shouldn't think that this is just a feature of Russian-U.S. relations. It is a steady feature of Russian relations with the entire developed world, and there is a huge budget in Russia that's being set aside to fund these sorts of escapades, these active measures campaigns, in other governments, particularly democratic governments.
Well, that's all that Putin knows. I mean, that's his background. His mindset has always been the main adversary, as they refer to the United States. And he's been a catastrophe for Russia itself, but he's been able to really screw with the US and NATO as much as he can. He's very good at it. And I thought that one of the more revealing things in the Guardian article is that Sir Andrew Wood, the UK's former ambassador to Moscow, who found these documents to be spellbinding, but he also said that they seemed completely accurate, the way that they describe the mindset of Putin, who, you know, simply doesn't believe that he does anything wrong and has to blame everything on the Americans and the CIA, etc. He can't accept the fact that in the invasion of Crimea was a mistake in as much as the backlash is not worth the gains. But that's, I thought, was really interesting, was not just that you got these experienced people like the UK's former ambassador to Russia verifying the documents, but also verifying Putin's mindset.
I think absolutely I agree with that. And frankly, you know, from what I've seen of the documents and the one page that was photographed and shown there, I mean, it looks and reads exactly like the work product of the Russian intelligence services at the highest level of Putin's brain trust. I mean, the language that's used, the analysis that's given, and also the rather fawning attitude adopted towards Putin, as you point out. But then let's also say their analysis of Trump is smack on the money. And let's note that there's not a suggestion here anywhere directly that Trump is an asset or an operative, but there is a very strong suggestion that they hold a portfolio of kompromat, which they can use against him. And that's important. So I think it really appears to stand up the essential conclusions of Christopher Steele and his dossier, and those of the major people who've been carrying forward this narrative about Russia. So this is, I think, a huge breakthrough.
Right. The documents refer to certain events that happened during Trump's trips to Moscow, and they go back to 1987 and not just 2013, which is what the salacious stuff in the Steele dossier was, the so-called PP tapes. And whether or not that happened is kind of immaterial. The most important thing that happened in Trump's visit to Moscow for the Miss Universe contest was that he expected to meet with Putin. Putin couldn't meet with him, but they set up a meeting in the Nobu restaurant in Moscow. And all of Putin's top oligarchs and Siloviki basically briefed Trump and gave him his marching orders to go back to the United States and start to divide America. And guess what happened? Trump goes back to the United States and starts the Bertha conspiracy, which gave right-wing Confederate Americans, the same people that attacked the Capitol, gave them the permission to be racist again and come out from under a rock. So the line is so straightforward that Trump was the perfect vehicle to destabilize and divide America and turn Americans against each other. And he has been the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, I definitely share that viewpoint. And I also think the evidence of his collusion with the Russians is quite overwhelming at this point. So, you know, you're never going to have maybe smoking gun evidence. And that's because of the nature of the beast. I mean, a professionally run intelligence operation is first and foremost always going to ensure that there are no fingerprints left in place, no compromising documents and so forth. I mean, the Russians are really very, very good at this, as are many other national intelligence services. This is as strong a portfolio of evidence as I ever expected we would be able to see.
Well, indeed, the former head of the KGB, General Kryuchkov, said in his handbook for Russian spies, never leave your fingerprints on a loose cannon. So yes. There you have their relationship with Trump. He wasn't a traditional agent. They didn't run him like an asset. They just knew that they owned him and that he would do their bidding. And boy, were they right. I thank you for joining us, Scott Horton.
My pleasure. Good luck.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the growing possibility that the $579 billion bipartisan infrastructure framework bill, which 11 Republican senators signed onto, will collapse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Karp, who is a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He is the award-winning author of The Move On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy, and Analytic Activism, Digital Listening and the New Political Strategy. And he has an article at the Washington Post, The Left is Pushing Biden to Spend More. It's a Sound Strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Karp.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today on Capitol Hill, the delegation from the Texas legislature, the Democrats, who had to skip out of town for a second time, they met with Joe Manchin to discuss both the infrastructure package and the fate of the For the People Act. Also today, of course, Minority Leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy, met with Donald Trump to plot how to win a bunch of seats or pick up seats from the Democrats. And apparently Chuck Schumer has told the Democrats that they better weigh in on the infrastructure package and get all of their input by next Wednesday. So does that mean that we'll hear something about what's really in this package later next week?
It means that we're going to hear something sooner rather than later, though I imagine that won't be the end of the negotiating. I imagine it's still going to be several months of step-by-step finding out what negotiations are left to be done.
But again, Manchin is pretty key, and so is Sinema. I mean, Sinema has said that Sinema is a co-sponsor of the For the People Act, so presumably she doesn't have any objections, whereas clearly Manchin does. But what do you think they have to do to make sure, because there's no room for error, is there? They have to have every Democratic senator on board to pass this via budget reconciliation.
Right. So there's two pieces of infrastructure legislation, which is part of what keeps this all complicated. There's the bipartisan infrastructure framework that hopefully gets 60 votes. Many progressive Democrats are skeptical that that will actually happen and have memories of the fight over Obamacare, where it just seemed to drag out and drag out and drag out in the hopes of bipartisanship. And in the end, what they were left with was a weaker piece of legislation that no Republicans voted for. And then separate from that, we have this reconciliation package, which, again, we'll get details of what's going to be in it soon. But I mean, that's just coming out yesterday. Those two things then may end up having to get merged if the bipartisan infrastructure framework falls apart. And on top of all of this, there's going to be some questions about what can go into the reconciliation package based on what the Senate parliamentarian decides. And all of this, as you noted, is going to come down to the veto points of Sinema and Manchin, making sure that they stand with other Democrats and actually vote for it. So there's still a lot of there's still a lot of balls in the air that are going to need to be caught and successfully kept going.
So let's talk about the bipartisan infrastructure framework bill that was announced a little while ago, $579 billion in new spending, largely actually on deferred necessities of bridges and roads that should have been done, fixed in the past, and not very heavy on what needs to be done for the future, and particularly dealing with climate change. So it's gotten a lot of criticism from the Democratic left. 11 Republican senators joined a board, but it looks like the Republican activists are trying to peel them off. There's a dark money effort underway to go after senators like Jerry Moran in Kansas. That dark money pack is headed up by Mark Short, who was the chief aide to former Vice President Pence. So what's your expectation then, David? Do you think, given what the Republicans are up to in terms of trying to peel off these Democrats, and they're pretty wavering. And then you've got McCarthy and Trump now meeting together. I'm sure they're talking about how to force the Republicans to give up on this bill. How certain are you, or what would the odds be that this thing's going to survive, this bipartisan infrastructure bill?
I wouldn't be ready to put odds to it. If I was given 50-50 odds, I would be a pessimist and say that I don't think Republicans are going to end up voting for something that would be a major victory for Joe Biden. The key point that I was trying to make in the article is the Biden administration would like these two infrastructure bills, or some combination of them, to be bold, to be bipartisan, and to be fast. Republicans, at a minimum, clearly want to slow it down so that Biden can pass less of his agenda after this happens. And there are strong Republican interests that would prefer it not to be bipartisan. So they can do to the infrastructure package what Republicans successfully did to the Affordable Care Act, of making it look much more radical than it is, slowing down the process, and while they slow it down, also convincing their audience, their public, that this is a radical piece of legislation. So at least some Republicans are going to pursue that same playbook. We're already seeing that. And they're going to be applying pressure to Moran and to various other Republican senators who are at least open to the potential of bipartisanship if the right conditions are met. What Democrats have to do in response to that is also apply pressure so that in the course of negotiating what stays in, what gets taken out, there's equal pressure, there's counter pressure on both sides. So that's the reason why, whether or not you believe that Republicans are operating in good faith when considering bipartisanship here on the bipartisan framework, it's still the right move from left-leaning organizations to be speaking loudly and pressuring loudly to try to make sure that Biden holds firm and doesn't give too much up.
Well, you would think that by now Joe Manchin would have learned that bipartisanship in the Senate is a chimera, given that Mitch McConnell recently said that 100% of my focus is to stop the Biden administration. And he was heavily invested in negotiating the bipartisan effort to have an inquiry into January the 6th storming of the Capitol. The Republicans reneged on that. And as you're suggesting here, David, they might well be stringing the Democrats along as they did over the Affordable Care Act and ended up getting compromise after compromise. And at the end of the day, not one of them voted for it. So does the bipartisan bill have to sort of blow up in their face before Manchin can then start thinking about the $3.5 trillion package?
That's not clear to me. And if I was in Joe Manchin's office, I would be telling him that evidence of bad faith from your Republican Senate peers is abundant. It is everywhere you look, and we should operate accordingly. I'm not in his office, though. So what will it take for Manchin and Sinema to decide, you know, we're waiting too long, we're giving up too much, and this is all operating not in good faith? I'm not entirely sure, since I would already be there personally if I was in their offices. But it does seem like the strategy that Biden and Pelosi and the rest of the leadership laid out when they announced this, that there would be a bipartisan bill and there would also be this reconciliation bill, and that they would make sure that both get passed before Biden is asked to sign one of them. That's a solid strategy so long as you can pull it off, so long as you can hold firm to it. And at least so far, they're holding firm to it. So if they continue to follow that, then that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily get the bipartisan framework, but it at least means that if that falls apart, if it is shown the Republicans are not operating in good faith, then they have a legislative vehicle ready for all the Democrats to vote for and still pass a pretty monumental piece of legislation.
So let's talk about the left having a sound strategy. One of the things that is emerging now is that a congressman who's pretty much on the left, Hakeem Jeffries, is expressing a lot of annoyance at some of the colleagues in the House on further to the left, like AOC and company, that they're going after, they're primarying a bunch of Democratic chair members, etc., who are all in the midst of these negotiations. So if you're a Democratic chair in the middle of these negotiations with Schumer and company on these big important bills, and you're looking over your shoulder and you're kind of annoyed that you're being sniped at from the left, that's not exactly the right kind of situation to be in, is it? In this situation, which is exactly why Akeem Jeffries is complaining about these efforts on the part of AOC and company.
I would say that it is better to have Akeem Jeffries a little annoyed than not annoyed at all. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a threshold of too much. It's possible to go too far, but I'm not seeing them do that yet. And in particular, the reason why it's good for leadership to be at least a little annoyed is that means that you are providing enough pressure that in negotiations with Republicans, where Moran or some other Republican who's trying to work with you says, look, I'm facing $25 million of dark money ads in my district. I'm really feeling the heat. I need to get you to give me more. If Jeffries and people like him are annoyed, then they can honestly say, we're facing heat too. We can't give too much. And the basic principle to keep in mind here is that politicians respond to pressure. So yes, the left should be at this stage pressuring. They should be at least a little annoying to leadership. And that's part of the job. I mean, part of the job of leadership is to get annoyed at these stages and then go on to do good work. Now, there will be a later stage. There will come a day when they actually need to vote on the legislation. And that will then be a different question, because then progressive legislators and progressive advocacy organizations will need to decide, is it time to say this is not enough, we need to stand against what Biden and team have come up with? Or do we say this is enough and we need to applaud what we have now and then keep working for more later? That's a different question than we're facing right now, because what we need to keep in mind is that right now the details are still being hammered out. And progressive organizations and progressive legislators aren't annoying leadership, then that actually doesn't – that does a disservice to the leadership. That means that they are in a tougher position when negotiating over what is going to be in this bill. The original framework that Biden released was tremendously bold. We want to keep as much of that boldness as we can if they're going to accomplish their Build Back Better agenda. And for them to do that, that means that progressive organizations, progressive legislators – ought at this stage to be a little annoying. It's strategic.
So this is not a case of one of the flaws of the left, that they'd rather be righteous than effective. The right, of course, is ruthless and they plow ahead, and ideological inconsistencies don't bother them because they're all about power.
Right. There are times and circumstances where that's a fair critique to consider. This is not the time. This is not the circumstance. It is an unvarnished good to be pretty annoying to leadership right now while the details are still getting hammered out. That's going to leave everyone with a better bill that they're more happy with.
And, of course, already major compromises have been made. Bernie wanted $6 trillion. Biden wanted $4.5 trillion. And now they're talking about $3.5 trillion. And maybe they'll have to compromise on that. So already a lot of compromise, David. What do you think, just in closing?
I mean, that's $3.5 trillion. If we add in the bipartisan infrastructure framework, gets up around $4 trillion.
Right.
While that's giving something away, if we could portal back to November 2020 and tell ourselves they're going to be compromising down to $4 trillion in infrastructure spending around a lot of things that are real progressive priorities, like the child tax credit and serious work on climate, I think we'd all be pretty happy if that was the compromise, if that was where the compromise was ending up. Now, again, it's too early to say this is great because we don't know what's to come next. But if we end up with $4 trillion in new spending on infrastructure, I'll be impressed.
Well, David Karp, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Karp, who's a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He's the award-winning author of The Move On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy and Analytic Activism, Digital Listening and the New Political Strategy. And he's an article at The Washington Post, The Left is Pushing Biden to Spend More, It's a Sound Strategy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing how Miami has become the exile capital of the world, with Cuban, Haitian, and Venezuelan exiles cooking up all kinds of plots. Use your heart and not your Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anne-Louise Bardak, who's a Penn USA award-winning journalist who has written for virtually all of the major media in the US and the UK, named the go-to journalist on all things Cuban and Miami by the Columbia Journalism Review. She's the author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of the Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Louise Bardak.
Welcome. Hi.
Well, thanks for joining us, Annie. And of course, Miami, which you've studied and written about, happens to be the kind of hotbed, if you will, of exiles from Venezuela, from Haiti, and from Cuba, all of which are countries in upheavals in various degrees. Venezuela, of course, for some time. It's obviously a failed state and a desperate situation. But now Cuba's had demonstrations, and of course Haiti's just had the assassination of its president. So does that mean that the Miami hotbed is heating up?
A lot, yes. The answer is yes, and a lot. I think what we're seeing here is the various exile groups, the most predominant one, the majority, at least in terms of the apparatus of power, would be the Cuban exiles. And then you also have Little Haiti, far less powerful, but still a force. And emerging over the last 10 years since Chavez has been the Venezuelans, and now, of course, the Nicaraguans who are fleeing the Daniel Ortega situation. But right now, all eyes are on Little Havana and basically a lot of exiles that are hoping to be the government and waiting to move on to the next step.
Well, they've been waiting for decades, haven't they?
62 years.
Well,
yes, exactly. And but they're now they're more than waiting. They're tapping their toes. And there's been several unprecedented events. First of all, in terms of the island, we have never seen demonstrations in 62 years from one end of the island to the other end of the island in over 30 cities or towns or provinces in Cuba. That's unprecedented. And that tells you that the level of discontent is deep, profound, and even a level of despair. For people who are used to pretty much being cracked down and repressed very quickly to take these chances. The other thing is people should take a good look at who's out on the streets in Cuba. And you will notice those are not, you know, what we thought of as the first wave white elites. These are very much mixed race, or Cuba, you use the word mulatto or mestizo or blacks. This is very much from the grassroots up, not just what were the original white elite that were part of the Fidelistas that came to power with Fidel Castro. So this is a very unique situation in Cuba. The other thing that jumps out to me is in Cuba, you never saw a police person, a woman, a policeman, or with a gun. For the Cuban army to shoot into a crowd, and reportedly, according to CNN, is carrying this, kill somebody, kill a protester, this is serious. This means that the threat is severe. For the other thing that grabs my attention is Raul Castro coming out of his retirement. He's 90 years old. He was 90 in, I believe, June 2nd. Coming out of this and feeling that he has to personally show up at the Partido, the Communist Party meeting, and that means he's back directing. And Raul Castro, over the years, going back to 94, which was the last major protest, which we called the Balsero, the rafting crisis. That was the last time. But the rafting crisis was more restricted to big cities like Havana, etc. This is all over the island. And there is no question in my mind that there have been mass arrests, thousands, that at every level people have been arrested. I mean, I'm not sure that thousands have been arrested, but thousands are affected. Certainly hundreds are being rounded up. And I think that you can connect that with the appearance of Raul Castro Monday at the Communist Party big powwow. And suddenly we're not seeing people on the street. Now, on the Miami end of it, you're seeing things like Miami Mayor Francis Suarez coming out and saying things like he likes the Panama model. Well, Panama meaning the U.S. invasion to take out Noriega. So we're having very, very heated rhetoric in Miami. And then we have DeSantis, of course, stepping in. And behind the scenes, all of this is a dress rehearsal for the 2022 elections and the 2024 presidential. So there is so much going on here, so much at stake. And it's playing out. And I think the next couple of weeks, we're going to see pretty fierce repression on the island.
And Anne-Louise Bardacker, you referred to Miami as the exile headquarters of the world, where you have the Cubans based in Little Havana, just west of downtown Miami, and a few miles to the north, the densely packed neighborhood of Little Haiti, and then the Miami Venezuelans dispersed, but they're concentrated in Doral. So just in terms of the politics, is this helping the Cuban-American senator? Little Marco, to quote Trump, because he's up against Val Demings. Do you think this is going to help him? Because the Democrats see him as being vulnerable.
Marco Rubio, I've written about extensively in Politico. I did a 10,000-word piece on Marco Rubio, and I remember him in the Florida legislature. For history buffs or people who want to know about gerrymandering in America, there is nobody who knows gerrymandering better, because I covered the gerrymandering of Florida, which is an art form. I don't think there's ever been a place as exquisitely gerrymandered for Republican districts as was done by Mario Diaz-Balart, who's now a congressman, and Marco Rubio, both of who were in the Florida legislature. So there's your background. They have carved up that state in a way that is almost impossible for Democrats. Plus, they added a bunch of seats to the Florida Supreme Court, which many people do not understand. So for me, when I look at Florida, I really do look at it as Trumplandia. It's a very steep incline, regardless of what's going to happen today for any Democrat, because it is finely honed gerrymandering. You have a Florida Supreme Court, and you have completely Republican-controlled legislature, and you have Ron DeSantis, who pretty much makes up rules as he goes along. You may remember that he just passed this big anti-riot thing. So if you're rioting and you're blocking a freeway or a highway, it's okay if you want to get home just to run people over. Well, a lot of Cuban exiles the other day blocked the Palmetto Expressway. They shut it down. I didn't see any police, and I didn't see any condemnation of that. In that case, it was okay. But I can guarantee you that, let's say, we're Black Lives Matter, or we're Haitians, or even Venezuelans, that would not be the case. But so Rubio, DeSantis, they are completely working one angle, which is the Cuba card here. And all bets are off right now, because they are arbitrarily and capriciously even enforcing the very own rules and statutes and laws they just implemented in the state of Florida. This is kind of inside baseball, but that is the extent of hardball. yes, Val Demings has a very, very steep incline just because she's a Democrat and also because of the cloud of the of Cuban Americans. But she's a strong Democrat because at least she's law and order. But the Democrats completely blew Florida in 2020. Sending Bernie Sanders down to campaign might be the one of the most idiotic ideas that's ever happened. A socialist to a state that's virulently anti-communist. So, yes, the incline for Val Demings is steep. And however, you know, 2022 is a year and a half away. So who knows?
Well, you mentioned, Annie Baddock, the 94 uprisings, and they were very similar in Cuba to the ones that just took place over the weekend in the sense that the people targeted those stores where you have to have foreign currency and dollars to, and you can buy anything. But in the other stores, the pesos-only stores, there's nothing to buy. And that's a source of great frustration in 94 and again over the weekend. In 94, of course, the people were able to flee taking rafts and neumáticos, you know, just literally tires. People were lost at sea in the droves. It's starting to happen again. But the Homeland Security chief himself, a Cuban immigrant, Mayorkas, is being quite emphatic. He said, "Allow me to be clear. If you take to the sea, you will not come to the United States." So the warning is out there. And of course, the truth of the matter is that more Cubans and Venezuelans and perhaps even Haitians are entering the United States or trying to on the Mexican border. And the maritime interdictions by the Coast Guards pale by comparison to the number of Cuban and Haitian immigrants taken into U.S. custody on the border with Mexico in May. 2,800 Haitians and 2,600 Cubans were encountered on the southern border. And because of COVID, they get turned back. So this is a different environment. It's much less hospitable, right, this time than it was back in 94.
Well, it's all politics. I say gracias a Dios, thanks to God, that at least Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland, is Cuban-born and is a Cuban exile himself. And that gives him a certain amount of gravitas, et cetera. I mean, what Biden does not want is Mariel. What Biden does not want is a Balsero crisis. Now, if Trump were in power, and
he'd love
Rubio, they would probably be saying, come on in, come on over. But again, not to put too fine a point on this, there is a race issue here. Take a good look at who's protesting. Not all Cubans are equal. There's racism on the island, and there's a great deal of racism in Florida, which is a southern state, and something the left doesn't quite understand. There's a very nuanced racism, and in some cases not so nuanced, amongst Hispanics. There's quite a pernicious system. So there's mixed feelings about those who would leave. I think there's a lot of desire for family reunification, but I wouldn't be surprised. We're not going to see wet foot, dry foot back in play again. But what we may see is, if you're Cuban, family reunification is okay. If you're Mexican, well, we're going to think about that. And if you're Haitian, we're definitely going to think long and hard about that.
But the idea of asylum seems to have gone out the window. Mayorkas said, if individuals establish a well-founded fear of persecution or torture, they are referred to third countries for resettlement. They will not enter the United States.
Well, he's taking a very harsh line because it's coming. This is all presidential politics. You know, Biden and the administration are saying to him, Ron Klain, we cannot have a refugee crisis. We have a border crisis right now, and the last thing we want to see it is on the high seas. as you said, we do not want to see a flotilla of ships. Now, you may recall that some of the more familiar figures who led flotillas historically already took off from Miami a couple days ago, and I'm sure there's individual efforts, you know, Ramon, Saul, Sanchez, you know, they were back, but the Coast Guard turned them back. So I think the message from the Biden administration is, we're not taking you. And I would say you have to look at this almost in a larger political context. If you look at the polling on Biden, his worst polling is on immigration and is on the border. So can you imagine, as we're a year and a half out from the elections, you suddenly have a refugee crisis. So I have a funny feeling that the Republicans in Florida are going to be playing this a few ways. They would love to foment some trouble. They want to say Viva Cuba Libre. But on the other hand, if there's a refugee crisis and a lot of people take to, they'll blame it on Biden. And because, you know, look at the ruling elites of Florida, whether it's Marco Rubio, whether it's Francis Suarez, whether it's Jimenez, whether it's Maria Teresa Salazar, who's a congresswoman, former, you know, Spanish language television host, this, they are pure white Cubans. So this is, let me just put it this way. They're not, they don't seem to be as welcoming as I recall them 10, 20 years ago.
Well, Anne-Louise Bardach, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Anne-Louise Bardach, who's a Penn USA award-winning journalist who has written for virtually all the major media in the US and the UK. She was named the go-to journalist on all things Cuban in Miami by the Columbia Journalism Review, and is the author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, as well as the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay